8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, after just 2 years on the Park City Council, Lynn Ware Peake's time as a council member ended this week. She joins me now to take a reflect on her short term. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
It maybe didn't feel so short to you, though.
Well, you know, it actually did, and it really made me, it kind of drove home why terms are 4 years, because I really felt like, even though I had, you know, a lot of institutional knowledge and had been around the city for a long time, it felt like it really took the 2 years that I was on council to kind of get going and feel like you find your voice and you find your place and all of that. So I'm pretty disappointed, I will have to say. Yeah. So
regrets that you didn't?
Well, no, I would have made the same decision again. You know, I feel, as people ask me, I say that it really was about technicalities, you know, the one being that we own property right next to the future Arts and Culture District, and I would have been recusing myself from everything. Although, you know, we were going to see the first approvals for that, or the pre-MPD, in September, October. So now that's kind of, you know, as a lot of things do, get put, you know, it's taking longer as things do. But definitely that will be a huge, I mean, really the biggest development change to Park City in a long time. And so, you know, that was one reason. My other reason was because of the change that we made here at KPCW, that elected officials could no longer be broadcasters. And, you know, I love what I do. You know, I love what I do here. And we do such a community service here, you know, at KPCW. And I felt like, yeah, so that was my decision. I'd make it again.
Yeah. So you were appointed to the council that after the election of Andy Bierman, that left his seat on the council vacant. And you, again, as you mentioned, came to council that after working as a city hall reporter and then actually served for a couple of years as community engagement liaison for Park City Municipal. Talk a little bit about how your relationship with and the understanding of City Hall evolved over that basically 8 years.
Well, you know, first I was an observer, and I think Emily Means, the city beat reporter here at KPCW now, could attest to, is that you are very, very well informed as a reporter, going to planning commission and going to city. So there's you're an observer, but you're probably about as well informed as you can get. And then moving into being community engagement liaison, what that did was really expanded my role in terms of reaching out to the community and learning, you know, who's in the community, what the issues are, who the leaders are, who are becoming the leaders. And so I really enjoyed that work. And then moving on to the council, then you become, you know, the conduit from those voices that you hear in the community to then make decisions based upon that. So it's been a really interesting ride.
Yeah. I believe you were the only Spanish-speaking council member. I mean, how would you recommend that the council connect with our Latino community moving forward?
Well, you know, it's funny. Just literally speaking the language does a lot. It goes very far. You know, we've had an issue with some parking over at the property we own in Bonanza Park. And, you know, going into a business that's Spanish speaking owned business and just talking to them in their language and saying, you know, here are the issues. It just seems to create a bridge that might not otherwise be there. And so, you know, not everyone speaks a second language. I just happened to really love it. It was an interest of mine, a hobby of mine. And so, you know, how you go forward, I think, is just learning as much as you can about another culture, especially those that are so prevalent in our community. And not only that, but looking at other diverse groups. You know, like, I've learned so much about neurodiversity just through hanging out at Lucky One's Coffee, you know. So it's educating ourselves. So often we don't know how to handle another group or reach out to another group or build bridges to another group because we just don't know what makes them tick. And so I think that's a job of all of us in the community.
Yeah. So do we have that conduit, though, with you being gone in terms of being able to
Well, I think so. I mean, to what degree? I mean, I could go through each of the council members and talk about their involvement with those diverse communities. But, you know, Max Doylney, for example, as a business owner, I know that over the years he's had a lot of people in the Latino community, Latinx, however you want to say it, community as employees. So there's really no better way of learning about a community than by employing them, because you really learn. And even through my husband's business, painting business, I've learned a lot about that community.
In terms of just kind of the last couple of years, what was your most difficult or perhaps conflicted vote that you had to make?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I think that there were decisions about the historic district and whether or not the decisions that seemed to come more clearly to those who had been on the Planning Commission before, council members Steve Joyce and Nan Worrell. And those were always kind of, they were conflicting. It was difficult to always arrive at a decision for me. And I can't call out anyone in particular. And there was, I think the vote when we were including the Snow Ranch pastures in the treasure bond, I voted against that. And that was difficult. I was conflicted about that because I didn't want the community to be confused about what that was. And luckily, the community voted in favor of the bond, you know, 76-78%. So I think it all turned out well.
Yeah. What do you think the hardest part of the job is? Or was, in your case.
You know, I think it's developing a thick skin. You know, no good deed goes unpunished, as they say. I think that you have a bunch of people, and I will say this for every person on that council, that care deeply about the community. And it's hard when you hear people stand up and tell you you're an idiot, for example. And, you know, you look at, that's a very small percentage of the population. Most people really applaud the work that you do and thank you for, you know, spending all the time that you do sitting up there and reading those huge packets and representing the community and in different, you know, various roles. But I think that's having a thick skin.
What do you think the most satisfying part of the job was?
Being a part of the community. Feeling like you make a difference every day in how the community is going forward, moving forward, and really making sure, you know, I love people and I love to listen to what they have to say. And I think that was the greatest thing, is taking that back up to the council and, you know, trying to be creative about solutions.
Yeah. Lots of big construction projects in the mill here. I mean, everything, as you mentioned, from Bonanza Park to Deer Valley to the base at Park City Mountain Resort. I mean, anything that you're kind of excited to see come to fruition, or even what happens up at Bonanza Flat?
Well, I'm actually looking really forward to being a member of the Bonanza Flat community. You know, I had to recuse myself from that, which was really difficult because that community up there, you know, they go, oh, great, we have this council person who's a property owner up here. But, you know, I had absolutely nothing to do with it, even to the extent that I wouldn't advocate even for myself as a property owner up there. So I look forward to that. You know, looking forward to just seeing how it is preserved and how we sort of respect that land up there. The Arts and Culture District, I'm really excited about. I think that area has been ripe for redevelopment for a long time, and I'm excited to see what Sundance and the Kimmel Arts Center are going to put as our anchor tenants there, and also what the city's going to do.
Yeah, and in terms of anything you feel like is you left unfinished?
Well, I think, you know, there are so many things with City Council that are ongoing. And I would say, you know, with our affordable housing critical priority, I think we still have to get a lot more creative about how we're going to meet our goal of 800 units. And so I think even as a community member, I'll still try to throw my ideas in there about, you know, making it easier for people to have affordable accessory units. Mm-hmm. ADUs, accessory dwelling units. There we go. And, you know, our work on social equity, I think, will be ongoing, and it's got a great start. I see it in all forms, all around the community, people coming up with ideas and Just last night I was at the MARC and there was a group of people who were from drug court, but the MARC was partnering with this group that gets them in the gym to work out. And, you know, you just see it in various facets and it's pretty heartening. I really like that.
So what's next for you?
Well, I'll keep doing my two shows here, Cool Science Radio and The Mountain Life. And I really enjoyed the liaison appointments. So I'm going to continue to serve with Communities at Care as their co-chair and on the Recycle Utah board. And then, you know, I just love the work that I did with the community. So I'll be looking. I'm going to take a little break and work on our house that we're building in Brighton Estates. And then hopefully, you know, have some continued employment here and or at Park City Municipal.
Okay, Lynn, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
First, as we've reported, Solitude Resort became the first resort in Utah to begin charging for uncovered parking. The resort's mission not to make money, but to encourage carpooling and better use of public transit. Then at the end of last month, Brighton Resort, Solitude's neighbor, announced that it would be making a change to its parking policy. For those single-occupant drivers, they're now required to either hoof it to the resort from a remote parking area or take a shuttle. Obviously, things are changing in the ski resort business. On the phone with Solitude, with an update of how that decision has fared so far this winter, I have the resort's communication manager, Sarah Huey. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
So it was a bold step for Solitude to begin charging for its outdoor parking. Is it working?
Yes, it's going very smoothly on site. And we're seeing a lot of positive changes, specifically increased usage of the UTA ski bus up Big Cottonwood Canyon. And anecdotally, we are seeing a lot more people carpooling as well.
Yeah. So tell us how the paid parking works. The more people in the car, the less they have to pay?
That's right. If you come up with four people in your car, it's only $5 to park your car for the whole day. If you have three people in the car, it's $10. One or two people, you need to pay $20 to park for the day. And we have seen that incentive, like I said, really making people think twice about hopping in their car. We all live so close to the ski resorts, being very lucky here in Utah, that I think it's easy to just, zip up for a few runs or run to the ski resort just like you would run to the grocery store. But in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons over the last few years, congestion has increased, and it was time to try something new to make people think twice about that choice.
Yeah, so are you offering better parking to those who do carpool with four people in the car? Or?
Yes, we do. We have a front row set aside on a space available basis for cars with four or more passengers.
Okay, so are you having to turn cars away because you have nowhere to park them, or have you had to do that in the past?
We did quite a few days last year have our lot full, and that was something that we were seeking to reduce this season. That was one of our goals and one of our kind of data points that we've got an eye on for this season. It's difficult to compare season over season, every season being different with different weather. That's the major factor. But we are seeing more skiers per car. And so as a result, I think it's fair to say fewer days when we're having to declare the lot full and turn people around.
Yeah, your counterpart there at Brighton, Jared Winkler, had told me that he guesstimated that as many as half of the cars coming to Brighton in the past have been single-occupant drivers. Is that the case for Solitude as well?
I don't have the exact numbers on it, but anecdotally, our crew in the parking lot is saying they're seeing a lot more cars with multiple people.
Okay. So if somebody wanted to take the bus up, I mean, how would they do that?
Sure. The UTA ski bus, that's route number 972, operates in Big Cottonwood Canyon, beginning with a number of stops across the south part of the Salt Lake Valley. And so the UTA, rideuta.com is the best resource for that route. Now, just a few months ago, UTA announced that they were increasing service this season, and we're very proud to be partnered with them. They've been a great partner to us throughout this announcement of our transportation changes, and so service is more frequent every day. It's 28% more trips in Big Cottonwood Canyon this season compared to last season, and Also, Icon pass holders can ride that UTA bus to and from Solitude for free.
Ah, they just need to show their pass, huh?
They scan it just like they would a bus pass.
Okay. And then what about your employees? How do they get to work?
The Solitude employee pass also functions as a UTA ski bus pass, and we have invested new for this season in 4 15-passenger shuttles to move groups of employees up and down the canyon as well. So we're taking out even dozens more cars out of the canyon.
Yeah. So, I mean, as somebody who maybe sit in a bus or a van, I mean, have you noticed a difference? Or is it still, or do we still see, you know, taking, I mean, can remember instances last year of loading out of the mountain, you know, taking a couple of hours for people to get down.
It's just so tricky to say season over season because the weather is such a variable.
Yeah. Yeah. And is this a pilot project or is this really just the future of Solitude's business plan?
Well, you know, time will tell. I don't anticipate that this policy will change in the foreseeable future. We are seeing positive effects already from the paid parking policy, as well as the other initiatives that we announced this fall. And in the Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons, congestion and traffic have been an issue for years. The resorts, as well as other interested entities, Cottonwood Canyons Foundation and so forth, have put in different instituted different policies, and this one was always on the table. But after last season being such an amazing season, both with snow and I think a lot of pent-up demand after kind of a poor snow season, we just knew we had to do something, and not just something, but everything, every option that was possibly at our disposal. And so we worked for a number of months to put together a comprehensive transportation package. And from what I've seen so far, it really is making a difference.
Yeah. And you had mentioned that UTA has added more service. Does that mean we'll see in the future perhaps more park and ride lots at the base of the canyon that people can access?
I certainly hope so. I think that that UTA is already seeing increased demand. And so, you know, that this kind of infrastructure does take some time, I imagine. But I am hopeful that in the future they will be able to contribute to that infrastructure to make it even smoother for people to take the bus to go ski.
Yeah. And it sounds like, I mean, you guys, as I mentioned, are just real bold in this. I mean, you think this is just really the wave of the future, that all at eventually at all resorts we're going to be paying to park like we do at Disneyland?
Well, as you mentioned at the top, we are the first resort in Utah, but this is not unheard of in other states. In fact, it's quite common in Colorado and California at ski resorts to have paid parking. And as you mentioned, you know, you go to Disneyland, you pay to park. You go downtown to watch a jazz game, you're going to pay to park there as well. It's a convenience, and it's a limited resource, and so putting a price tag on that helps people think twice before going by themselves or, you know, consider those other options, public transportation and so forth.
Okay, Sarah, anything you wanted to add in?
Let it snow, let it snow.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, as we've reported, the Park City Institute has begun to take steps towards new leadership. Executive Director Terry Orr leaving March 1st. In the meantime, Ari Ioannidis, a longtime financial supporter of the Institute, is joining the organization as managing director. And the current five-member board will be growing. Joining me now in the studio, I have the current president of the board, Jason Owen, along with managing director Ari Ioannidis and Director Terry Orr. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Ari, why don't you just start and tell us a little bit about how this came to be? And, I mean, are you managing director or you will be managing director? Or
I think it's all semantics. I'm at the office every day now. The board has nominated me, and we're waiting on formal action. But I'll say that, you know, Ember and I have been supporters of the Institute for a long time. We love Terry. And we love the arts, and there's no better supporter of the variety of arts that we get through through the Institute. So Terry and I have been speaking for a long, long time, actually.
Yes, this isn't anything new for us. It may be new publicly, but Ari, as he said, he and Amber have been supporters for a long time. But as I started to transition, I reached out to Ari and Amber and asked for their advice and support.
And, you know, Amber's been through several executive changes, so it's something that, you know, I've seen a lot. And having been active with boards and executive directors and with several nonprofits, that was a great sounding board for Terry. So it really made sense. She's asked me several times to become more involved. Being here full-time now, it just seems like the perfect time.
Yeah. And we've heard from Terry, of course, over the last couple of years, basically since the Institute lost the lease at Deer Valley, about how difficult it has been to make this work. How is the financial situation today?
Well, I'm going to say this. When I look across the landscape of nonprofits, specifically those in the arts across the United States, it is a very hard time. You know, look at the ballets, the symphonies, anyone who's involved in performing arts. It's a really tough time right now across the United States. There are some standouts out there who are doing a really good job. And I think that what we're going to do is apply principles that, you know, I've learned over working with several of the nonprofits that I'm involved with, specifically Boot Up and Recycle Utah, and hopefully apply those here. So it's kind of a different trek. And I'll say this, Terry's done a great job. She's a wonderful sounding board, but And I was a founding director of sorts when I started my company. It's hard to learn all these things and get them all right with a very small group. Having an old guy like me come in with a little more experience, I think, will help.
Yeah, but I get...
And that said, I would just say that in the past few weeks, we have managed to put ourselves in a terrific forward position. We've had a number of loans that have been forgiven. We've had an infusion of cash into the organization. So I would say our position today is very healthy, still with work to do.
Yeah, I would say right today, sitting here, the position of the Institute's better than it's been financially in 3 years.
Okay, because I know, Jason, that the board didn't approve a New Year's Eve show, and that was because you didn't have money to put one on.
Well, I think more than anything, we were just looking to be really fiscally responsible and conservative as we were trying to kind of find this path forward with Terry and the Institute. And, you know, as we joined on an interim basis about 6 months, we took a ton of look at all sorts of strategic options. And more than anything, I think we're extremely happy that we found a friend in Ari that is going to be stepping in and helping the Institute, because our objective over this period of time was always to find solutions on how the Institute could thrive in Park City and be a very valuable asset to the community for the arts over the next 25 years to build on what Terry's done for the first 25 years. And that was the most important part, and that is why we're so excited that we're here with Ari today to find this path forward.
Okay. So the press release had said that we'll be growing the board. Do you stay on?
You know, I think right now we're trying to make sure that we walk through the different steps of bringing Ari on and nominating him and look for new members to join, and some people will most likely be leaving. And so I think all these things are up in the air at this point. But again, I think as we think about these things, it's about tomorrow, the next day. It's about the Santa Fe Ballet coming in February. It's about all of these types of amazing things with the winter season that are coming that we're really excited about.
And Ari, you had said that in the press release that you're working with a small group of dedicated longtime supporters donating time and resources. Who does that include?
Well, some of our longtime supporters have always remained anonymous, but I would say Terry has done a really good job getting some people. I have several longtime supporters who have expressed interest in joining the board and becoming part of the organization, and I'm reluctant to say who they are at this point without the board actually taking action, because any of that would be speculation. But Terry's done a great job working with some of our premier supporters financially to help really make the organization, I think, more financially viable. If you want to talk about specific people?
I do. Yeah. Michael Zaccaro at the St. Regis certainly is at the top of the list, and he is back in for, I think this is his 11th season as the summer sponsor. So there will be a summer concert series, whatever questions there were about that. And St. Regis will be the title sponsor. Ann McCoy, who of course hired me, is stepping back in to lend advice and support. And she and Mac and her real estate firm have been supporters all along. And there are a number of folks in the community like that. You know, Betsy Wallace from Sundance is certainly a friend of the Institute, and she has she and her husband Ed are supporting a show this winter season. I think you can see on the list of people that are underwriters of shows. So lots of longtime people, and then some people who wish to remain anonymous, who've been anonymous, who we even call Mr. and Mrs. Anonymous, and they are going to continue their support also.
So it says that the press release that you'll stay on as founder and director emeritus. What does that mean? Are you are you a paid employee now of the Institute?
Yes, I am.
And will continue to be?
For a while, yeah. I love the title because, of course, it's the same title that Sundance gave John Cooper. So I don't know what it means either, but it's a great title.
Yeah, I mean, how do you see that? I mean, so what happens as of March 1, I guess? That's when the title changes, but the position, I mean, what is it you'll be doing?
I'll still be working with the Institute. I'll be stepping back or sideways or whatever language makes sense. But I'll be there to help with agents, to help introduce people, to help massage the transition with major donors and minor donors. That's the role that we've kind of worked out.
Do you envision that as a permanent or a temporary
position? I think it's a transitional. And Terry and I have talked a lot about this and with Jason and the board. And I think that, you know, if you were to take someone as big as Terry, I don't mean large.
Thank you, Ari.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Someone who has that kind of, you know, just the space she takes up and the things she does and how she has her fingers on everything, and just pull her out of the organization just quickly, that's not a good transition. I need to come up to speed. Yes, I'm a musician. Yes, I've put on shows before. Yes, I've hired speakers. Yes, I've run a nonprofit, but I need to know all the intricacies of what's going on, and Terry has to be there. So I think I'm there now doing a lot of things. She's allowing me to make some nice decisions.
We're working together.
We are working together, and Terry's been great to work with, and I want to give a big shout-out to Jason. He's been very responsive and easy to work with, too. So it's been a great way to work. So Terry will stay on. March 1st, things like who signs checks and bank things and technical, who makes reports to the board, that'll change. That'll be a switch. Terry will be there helping us get that new summer season going, showing me how things work. She will stay in her office. She will continue to be paid. We will still see her at events. And then over time, you'll see me transition into that role more and more.
So from managing director to executive director, is
that
where you see
that? That's the plan. It's subject to what the board decides.
Yeah. Sure, sure. And it's been a while, if ever, and Terry, you can correct me here, that the Institute has had a development position, I mean, which is unusual for a nonprofit organization. Will there be a development director going forward?
I think those are the things that the board is looking at. It was something that just evolved. I really was hired to be the development person in the very beginning to help build the building of the Eccles Center. So there was no programming when we first started out. There was just development. And then the programming evolved. So we kind of did it, you know, back asswards. But we are looking forward to, you know, with the board and Ari's figuring it all out, to have those positions that have been missing. So there was no programming director. There was no development director. There was an executive director who was all three of those roles.
Okay. Anything else that we need to get to? Jason, do you have anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think all in, we're just very excited that we found a solution for the long term so that the Park City Institute can be a pillar of the arts for the community for a long period of time and really kind of make sure that we've got fantastic people at the helm. Terry's got it, been to be staying in a great position. And as we walk through all of these steps, we're just really, really excited.
Okay.
I'd like to say one more thing. Go to our website, find a show you want to go see, buy the tickets. Come down to the Eccles. You will be blown away. There's some great shows coming up.
And we can talk briefly just about Stephanie. She had to cancel for health reasons. Do you expect her to come back, or should people just hold on to their ticket?
You know, that's up to them. They can certainly use those tickets for another show this winter. She is coming back. The scheduling, until we know how her health is going, we can't schedule. Her agent can't schedule. But she's very committed to still fulfilling the date.
Okay. And again, if somebody couldn't make that future date, you could get a refund or use it for another show.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, guys. Thanks for coming
in. Great. Thanks, Leslie.
Well, one of Park City's most iconic personalities, Iris Sack Sr., is the subject of a new documentary that will open the Slamdance Film Festival later this month. Joining me by phone, I have the filmmaker of the film. It's titled Film About a Father Who, that's Lynn Sacks, along with the co-founder and director of Slamdance, Peter Baxter. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Peter, let's start with you and have you give us the Reader's Digest version of this year's festival, the number of films, the submissions you had, how many new filmmakers you've got coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good morning, everyone. Well, it's been a 2019, actually, for the 2020 festival was a record-breaking one. We received over 8,500 submissions for this year's festival, and we'll be at Treasure Mountain Inn, showing just over 100 of those selections, programmed by filmmakers, for filmmakers. All of the program that we have at the festival this year has been selected then by filmmakers who've been part of Slamdance before, an artist-led organization, as you know. And this program really speaks to the filmmaker community. And the choices that were made, I think, are really exciting. And we've got, obviously, a really exciting opening night film here with Lynn's film, a film about a father, to kick things off.
Yeah. Tell me, what stood out about Lynn's film, the subject matter or the filmmaking? And Lynn, of course, not a new filmmaker. In fact, I think I read that she's made about 35 films, and you have always said that you're about the new filmmaker.
What's remarkable about Lynn's film and really stood out for us is that we believe it's breaking the boundaries of documentary filmmaking. Here we have a family, and most families have fallouts, and the ruptured and the intense one in Lynn's film, amazing documentary, reveals how far bloodlines can stretch without losing connection altogether. And though this is an extremely personal film and artists several times really choose between love and hate, she's really exploring a universal theme that we all think about from time to time, which is the extent to which one human being can really know another. And in this case, it's her dad. And this really makes for a remarkable film, a type of documentary that we haven't seen. And for this reason, we really wanted to present it as our opening night film.
So, Lynn, let's bring you into the conversation. How is your dad? I haven't seen him around in a few years.
He's doing well. He also spends quite a bit of time in warmer weather in Florida when the weather is, when Park City is in full snow time. But he's doing fine. He's good, and he still loves the landscape and the community of Park City. So it's very meaningful to all of us to have the world premiere for this film in Park City.
Yeah.
His hometown.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, he was quite the skier, so he's kind of given that up.
Yeah, it's a little too challenging these days, and he wants to continue a good long life, and I guess he feels a little hesitant to be out there on the mountains. Yeah.
Sure.
But he would be there the first day of the season, and he'd close down the slopes at the end of the spring.
Yeah. I've met your dad over the years, and so I understand why he would make such a great subject for a film. But to make it, I mean, you've got to have the film, the video. I mean, it's not like he's a rock star with lots of archival footage. So where did all of the film come for this?
So I actually decided I wanted to make a film about my father in 1991 and started doing interviews, and I made many other films in between, and you mentioned I've made 35, but I want to point out some of them are very short because I make those longer personal essay film documentaries, but also I'm very keen on short sort of art pieces. But anyway, in 91, I just said, my dad's been such a big presence in my life in all different kinds of ways, and also in my siblings. And but also in the community, and the film does focus more on our family dynamics. You get a sense of the community, and there's lots of material from Park City, but I couldn't cover every year of the 83 years he's lived his life. But I was always shooting Super 8 material. The first footage I shot was actually in 84 before I realized that it was going to be a longer film and really like a portrait of his life. But then in 91, I officially started the movie and then continued to shoot almost every time we were together for many, many, many years until this year.
All right. So it is an authorized biography. Tell us about what you wanted to show the world about your dad.
I guess one of the things I was trying to explore is that as much as we can know a parent, we also have limitations. It's like the parent leaves an imprint on you, and you know you're carrying that throughout your life, but also that parent goes on and continues to have his or her own relationships, and my father certainly did too. So there were parts of his life I knew a great deal about, and other parts that were, more secretive. And so that all became much more open in the last few years, and we had deeper conversations about it and were able to investigate that. And so I think it's not like the kind of thing where some people want, you know, they go back and they do intense interviews and then they have a kind of complete understanding. I'm actually as interested in the search as I am in what you find.
Yeah. And part of that whole dynamic there, of course, you're one of nine kids of his.
That's right.
Two wives. I don't know. And I think that maybe the other children from girlfriends as opposed to kind of a legal situation or.
Actually, there are six mothers and nine kids. And some of the moms were two of the moms were wives and the others were girlfriends. And some of my siblings were born actually the same year, but from different moms. So it was an inventive situation and sometimes challenging, and so because we weren't always prepared. I think that was a big part of it, like how you prepare for the news, how you prepare to love another person, how do you deal with a person you didn't know about, and then you find out about and you're. You want to embrace them, but you also have to figure out how they fit into your psyche.
Yeah. So are you close with your siblings of different women besides your mother?
Actually, we are very, very, very close. And I would say that my father, it's kind of like nine, it's a coincidence, but it's a bit like nine planets. So we all circulate around him in different kinds of ways. For example, one of my sisters, Julia, I had just gotten to know in the last 5 years, but we're very, very close. She lives in Park City because there's a certain kind of way that we understand each other through my dad. It's like he has a, shall I say, like a language, and you get it or you don't, but most of us do get it, and so it brings us closer.
Yeah. Now, does the film delve into his imprint here in Park City? Of course, he was the developer of Park City's first chain hotel, the Holiday Inn, now known as the Doubletree, formerly known as the Yarrow.
There's a shot of the Yarrow in the film, and there's a lot of shots. You probably will recognize a few people in the film. One of my dad's closest, there's just a brief shot. One of my father's closest friends, who's no longer with us, is in the movie, and you get the feeling of Park City. There's a lot of Wasatch Mountain landscape material. People will see how much the landscape has changed because some of my footage goes back to the 80s. So, it's kind of, in a way, a document of that transformation.
Yeah, well, and he was probably, I think, one of the first people with a cell phone, and he used to carry that brick-sized phone attached to him skiing all of the time. You got any footage
of
that?
You're going to see that in the movie. Yeah. When we called it a mobile phone, yeah. But his very first phone was set up in a car, when we all are from Memphis, Tennessee. So he was definitely one of the first people to have a phone because, as he says in the movie, that's the way he did business. Yeah. And also with a shoebox.
And he wouldn't be bashful in saying that he loves women, beautiful women, and he always surrounded himself with beautiful women. Is that part of this at all?
Definitely. Definitely. I'll just say I don't hold back on that.
Yeah.
Because being a daughter, you have to reckon with it. You have to either run away or you have to face it. You have to, being a feminist, you have to figure out how you're going to embrace that situation. And I did my best to explore it and to also know that he lived his own life. And they, I also really tried to connect with those women and to figure out what it would be like to be those women, not through conversations that are in the film. So it's both a kind of like a cubist piece where you see my dad from a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, well, as a pot smoker, too, because I know he liked to smoke pot.
That's addressed, definitely, in the film. I talk about that.
Yeah. And at one time, he owned a hotel in Bali. Does the film take us to Indonesia?
Actually, it does. That's the very, very, very first footage I shot was in 84, because I was with my dad in Bali with my sister Dana. So it's so funny. You know a lot about my father, going back like 35 years.
I've been watching him from a distance, yeah. Tell me, what does he think about the film?
He is really supportive. I'll say my dad cried, and it's one of the first times I've seen him cry, and that was extremely moving to me. But, for anybody to see your life on a screen, he saw it while I was working on it, and he saw it just recently. I came to Park City, and I showed it to him at his house.
Nice.
Because I wanted him to be able to see what was in it. But, most of us, we move past the years of our lives, and there might be our snapshots of birthday parties and holidays, but this is all the things in between.
All right. I just have another minute or so. I know there's a lot of locals, though, who would love to see your film, Lynn. After Slam Dunce, does it come to the Park City Film Series, Netflix? Do we know?
I know the next screening will be at the Museum of Modern Art. It's going to be here in February for the New York premiere for a couple of nights. And then I'll go on. I'm happy to bring it back to Park City, so I'll figure that out. But really, I'm just like starting the whole journey with this movie. And so I'll keep people posted on that.
All right. Well, Peter, thanks for bringing Lynn's film to Slam Dunce. Real quickly, tickets and passes on sale?
Yeah, we're very excited about bringing Lynn's film to Slam Dunce. And tickets for Lynn's film and other films at Slam Dunce can be actually purchased along with passes on slamdance.com. That's where everything can be found, including the schedule. And the festival runs the 24th of January through the 30th.
Yeah. And real quick, back to you, Lynn. Did you and your brother, Ira Jr., have to draw stalls, or that you had already told him back in the 90s that you were making a documentary? I know your brother did
asked all the right questions. Well, Ira made a film called 40 Shades of Blue, which was a veiled portrait of my dad, because it wasn't exactly my dad, and Rip Torn played the part of the quasi-Irish act. So there were a lot of differences. And that film took place in Memphis. And so Ira makes narrative films, and I make more experimental, personal documentary films. But there is definitely footage in my movie that Ira shot in Russia with my dad, which I think people will find very interesting, especially with all the conversations around Russia. So my dad was doing business, but also having a very good time, which he always did. It was always a combination. It's always and continues to be a combination of both of those things.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Peter Baxter, Lynn Sachs, thanks for your time this morning.